5. I'm pregnant, Myatt told me one morning as we lined up for the fields. The look on my face unnerved her. She squeezed my hand. Don't be so sad, Charles of Earth. I didn't know, I said. Didn't know what? Myatt asked. That we could even have a child. She was Venusian, but we all were humanoid, as Eric had noted in our first days trapped together. He had talked about common evolution, or panspermia, or even more fanciful reasons why the human form existed here. And then the real horror of it all struck me. What life will my child grow into? I asked. I thought about myself at 4, free and playing in the grass, ignoring my mother's call to come inside. I tried to imagine bringing my own child along to the fields to unload the ships, seeing my child whipped and broken. There are many here who are generations old, Myth said. We will adapt, all adapt. But there was a note of sadness and resignation in her voice. I could hardly see the ground in front of me for days. My world revolved around the stone street out to the field where the airships landed. I could count the stones on the walk to and from the common house with my eyes closed, half asleep in the early morning shamble out, and the tired shuffled back to what I'd come to regard as home. My dreams, when I was rested enough to dream now, turned from trying to remember what blue skies looked like to dreaming of flying. It took me a long while to understand what my subconscious mind had decided, as I had slipped into a dark place while thinking about bringing a child into this world. But one day, watching the silvered airship approach and drop its single bow line, I knew how I would leave. I wouldn't run. I would fly. I'd been walking in and out of the cabins of these ships for so long. I knew the layout, and although I couldn't read Venusian, I had some sense of the controls. I'd been a pilot in the war, after all. The Venusian airship designs were better than the old Nazi ones we'd seen in newsreels. The Venusians compressed the helium inside into tanks, letting the airships glide down onto the ground and unload cargo without shooting up into the air. The bow line was a formality, probably a holdover from when they'd been more like the airships on Earth and always lighter than air. It took just a few minutes to pump the helium back into the airship's envelope. That, I thought, would be the trickiest segment of my plan. But I wouldn't be able to fly it alone. The longest stretch of work came as I worked to convince the overseers to bring Shepard and Eric over to our estate, promising them that the three of us would work harder, despite the nightly beatings we would surely suffer for rising above the pack. That took working extra hard to get noticed by the overseers so I could sell them on the idea. And that meant barely sleeping in a corner with a small piece of metal I'd rubbed into a sharp blade against a stone edge, to protect Myatt, my unborn child, and myself. When the Lord approved the purchase, and the overseers shoved a very thin Eric into the common room, I barely recognized him. Emaciated, his hair unkempt, he collapsed by my blanket and slept. It was hellish, Shepard told me as I kept watch with my blade. They were working us to death, building a seawall for real ships. Knee-deep in the water, moving rocks however we could, bit by bit. I kept telling them I was an engineer. We could do better with machines, and they beat me every time. I learned to shut up pretty quick. It's better here, I told him. And Shepard began to weep silently and thank me for getting them moved. They were not surprised by Myatt, or to find that she was pregnant. Eric shrugged and wasn't even fascinated by the fact. How quickly our priorities could change. From heroes of a nation to weeping about being moved to a less servile state. I told them about Commander James, and Shepard nodded. They took our bracelets away and sold them as trinkets to the children. Sometimes I would lie awake, hoping one of them ate the pill, and other times I hated myself for thinking it. I understand, I said. Now, get some sleep. I watched over them that first night in the dark like a feral mother cat, until Shepard woke up and spelled me. In the days that followed, we set watch each night and got enough sleep to survive. I waited for Eric to get his strength back before I began whispering my own plan to them. They blanched at first, thinking about Commander James's fate. This is not a revolt. This is running off into the bush. There were a lot of people who managed it and built lives for themselves. I thought of the runaways who had lived in the mountains of Jamaica that my father would tell tall tales about.
When do we make a run for it? Shepard asked.
When we're done unloading and everyone is going back. We cut the moorings and leap aboard. We'll only ever have one chance, and we'll have to make sure there aren't armed Venusians aboard. I won't know the best moment to do this ahead of time, but if I call for you, do not hesitate. The Venusians at my estate let us keep possessions, though the overseers ransacked through them on random occasions. I'd been storing cured meat that we'd been given and a kind of hard bread. A few water sacks hid the stuff that could get us in trouble. Food, water, a handmade metal knife, some needles and thread that Myatt kept hidden for herself so she could mend her rough-spun clothes. This was everything we owned. I hadn't told her what we planned, though I began to suspect she knew. We would head for the northern swamps, near the foothills we'd crashed at, hike over the nearest pass we could find, and if we made it, off into areas few and Kish cared to visit on the other side. And then, maybe, we could figure out what to do. Eric spoke of rescue and scanning the skies. I thought about hacking a small farm out of the wilderness. Shepard knew how to build traps. Even if we died, we reasoned, we would die once again free. We just needed the right airship and a little bit more food to hide in our water sacks, and we could make the run. The Nazis, though, destroyed our careful plans by arriving one uncharacteristically chilly morning. The three Nazis had been captured 10 days ago, the overseers told us, on an island to the west. They still wore muddied but tattered German uniforms with Nazi insignia on the shoulders.
You should be excited to have more of your tribe here to work alongside you, the proud overseer who had arranged the sale explained and pointed at Eric and Shepard. Just like these two.
But they aren't like us, I explained. They're from a different country, one we're at war with.
War?
The overseer talking to me found that curious.
Well, there is no war for you here, just more like you. You're the same, so you will work the same.
Left alone, we all eyed one another warily. I realized that Eric and Shepard looked to me for a decision. I wanted to kill them for blowing us out of the sky with a missile, but I knew that would only draw attention to us. The Nazis took the first move, though, introducing themselves nervously. Their commandant, Hans, spoke in lightly accented English.
They captured us when we landed. We thought we were going to be the first Germans to liaise with their
civilization, but instead they destroyed our rocket ship and captured us. They refused to believe we came from above the clouds, and they put us and all our stuff in cages. They took us around by aircraft to manors and showed us off to royals and important people. Like animals, another Nazi, Jost, spit. They put collars on us and chained us. We escaped once, but they hunted us back down. We killed a few of them, Hans said, satisfied with himself. So they sold us off. We were too much trouble. I stood impassively for a while, then held out changes of clothes, rough spun fabric, just like the gray clothes we wore. Well, it won't be nice like that anymore, I said. Now, you will be working.
That will give us more time to plan, Hans said.
To do what? I asked.
Gather what tools we can to fight, the commandant said.
It's been tried, I told him.
What these creatures need is the right kind of leader, a decorated fighter, a strong strategist. I commanded a panzer squadron in Egypt,
Hans said, his chest sticking out. Get dressed, I told him. If you take any longer, the overseers will come at us. As the Nazis changed clothes, Eric whispered,
Are we going to let them join us?
I shook my head.
But they're humans, he said. The only other ones. Surely we have an obligation. We were shot out of the sky by a Nazi missile, Eric, I whispered back. What makes you think they won't try to kill us again? Are you willing to bet everything on that?
The Nazis would not speak around Maat and viewed her with suspicion, so I kept her close as we worked their first day. Will you run with me? I asked her. She showed me her scarred arms.
I was free once. They bound me to the pole and scarred my arms to teach me my lesson. But I would be free again. Yes.
I would have hugged her there, but there was work to be done. That night I snuck my blade between Hans's blankets as he slept. Afterward, we tiptoed over to a new place in the common house. Before the Nazis woke up, I found an overseer. The Nazis were enemy combatants, I told myself. Men who would see people like my grandparents eliminated from the world. That was what I had believed when I joined the army. Yet, on some dark nights, I'd wondered. After all, what were the Nazis but the ultimate endpoint of European colonialism? Nazis were even white people who had told other white people they weren't white enough. They were white people who had invaded and colonized other white countries to spread their concept of a master race. Much like those invaded Europeans had once colonized other countries and told the brown people there that they were the master race. Was what the Nazis did to Europe different than what Belgians did to the Congo? My family had experienced things close to Nazi beliefs on our own home front. Enough that I could shiver and wonder what the point of the fighting was in darker moments. But I reminded myself, Nazism was purified European colonialism, a heady alcohol to the weak beer of American colonialism that was somewhat more survivable. Despite the lynchings, there'd been no total ethnic cleansing. So I joined the World War and fought, and to my bitterness, seen the war continue on. Seen the war spread even into outer space as we raced Hitler to other worlds. No, it would not leave me sleepless to do what I planned, I thought, as I woke the overseer to tell them about the knife. We woke, hours later, to the sounds of human screams. The Nazis hung bound from three poles. Outside, we found Hans, slumped forward, dead, my crude knife sticking out of his neck. The other pair wailed and wept as the colorful leeches sucked and tore into their skin. The overseers had questioned the other Venusians about knife-waving humans, and they pointed to the corner of the common house. One human looked like the other to them, and I'd moved my small group away from the Nazis, who were wearing our old clothes. I'd told Maat to sleep somewhere else. We take an airship today, if the chance is there, I said to my fellow remaining humans. They'll all be focused on other things right now. 6. The Nazis screwed things up for us. I'd had to use my homemade knife, and now I didn't have anything to cut the airship's bow line with. So I stood by the tie-down point as casually as I could, a large sack of grain on my shoulders, and loosened the massive knot until it slipped free. I left the line loose around the great sand screw sunk 10 feet into the ground. From a distance, I hoped it would look like it was still tied. And then I nonchalantly returned after dropping the grain off. I could hear Shepard swearing from inside as I loped back into the cabin. 2/3 of the cargo had been shuffled out by the unloading crew. 6 Venusians were inside with us, and 1 overseer lounged against the wall of the cargo bay, watching the unloading, shouting and smacking us with his club when he deemed us too slow. Eric leaned over.
Do we wait for everyone to leave with their cargo?
Now, I hissed.
And the Venusians?
Once we're off the ground, they can jump out if they want to stay, or join us if they want freedom, I said. We'd wanted a few more days to plan the exact attack on an airship, but we had our chance. Normally, several overseers stood inside to watch us. Normally, they were more vigilant, but they'd gotten their troublemakers this morning. They were sated from the violence and punishment. Eric and I attacked the overseer from each side. We wrapped a ripped-open water sack around his head to muffle his cries. We yanked him beneath bags of grain, and I crushed his neck with the heel of my foot repeatedly, until the soles of my feet struck metal. Shepard ran into the empty control room and triggered the helium release valve, reversing the flow from the pressurized tanks. The hiss was loud, and I glanced down the bay. No armies of overseers swarmed us yet, though they were turning, their large, dark eyes opening in realization. Fellow people, I announced to the whole cargo bay, we are stealing this ship, and if you would like to flee with us, you are welcome. If not, run for the ground. 2 Venusians ran, jumping out of the bay. It was already 3 feet off the ground. They rolled on the grass, and for their loyalty were treated with kicks from enraged overseers. One of them grabbed the lip of the open bay, struggling to get aboard. I kicked at his hands as we continued to rise into the air. He looked up at me, hanging from the edge, such hatred and astonishment in his eyes. I stomped his fingers until he screamed and let go. He dropped 10 feet to the ground, his legs folding awkwardly under him. The other Venusians turned and ran back for their rifles as we rose higher. The violent lasers cracked and sizzled the air, but I ran forward with Shepard to jam the engines full on. When they droned to life, the airship surged away even faster. Later, I walked back to the open bay and looked back at the stone towers of Kish as they receded in the distance. We passed over the swamps and marshes that surrounded it. Something with a giant, sauropodian neck peeked its head out of the treetops and bellowed at us. We were a craft of free people. 7. When my son turned 5, I sat him down. It is time to tell you who you really are and where you really came from, I said. I told him that he was from the tribe of humanity, from the world of Earth.
Where is that?
He asked. Far above the veil of gray, I pointed at the clouds.
Will we ever go back?
He asked. Most likely not, I told him. Maybe war had consumed them all. I remember the stories soldiers told of a new superweapon both sides had supposedly tested out in the deserts of Nevada and North Africa. A bomb that could unleash hell itself and destroy the world many times over. I hadn't heard of any new Earthmen being captured or coming through the skies, so maybe the atom bomb had been used. Or maybe Earth assumed that the surface of Venus was too dangerous, as both missions there had failed to return. But I told my son of the blue skies and beautiful places I'd seen, about his grandparents and great-grandparents, all the history I knew. One day, you or your child will stand tall among the Venusians, I told him. He looked more like his mother than me. And while it complicated our relationship, I knew at least some small part of what he was going through. But always remember where you came from. When he hugged me, his face showed that he didn't understand. But I would continue to tell him anyway, until the stories lodged deep and could be carried onward.
I know I'm of the tribe of Earth, he said,
and then left to play in the wading pool near the common house. It was hot, and the splashed water cooled him. He never asked about the scars on my arms, but one day I would have to tell him I'd been branded as a runaway, that the overseers marked me and would beat me for the slightest provocation. I never told him his own mother, Mayet, cut her throat when they finally caught us. They had followed a homing beacon still working in the wreckage of the airship. They found where we ditched it and spent months tracking us through the fetid jungle. I never told him that the mild-mannered scientist, Eric, threw himself in front of laser fire to save my son's life. I never told him why his uncle, Shep, limped so horribly. These things he would discover the truth of sooner or later, and I wanted it to be as late as possible. On Earth, many slaves living in the very country I had risked my life to protect had in the past tried to run away, like I had, and been dragged all the way back across states, hundreds of miles, to the place they'd run away from. Some across countries. Because a successful runaway was a precedent. They'd spent resources to hunt us down and bring us back. And in some ways, I'd been no different than Heston. I'd assumed I was smart, different, special, that I would be the one to beat the odds. I knew more now. More of the maps and paths and geographies out past Kish. I knew them better than ever before, but to risk the run was to risk my innocent child's flesh to torture or worse for being a runaway if caught. When he was older, I thought, maybe he would want to try to escape with us. Or maybe not, and I would have to leave him to face life on his own. But I couldn't leave him now. This is how so many in the past must have gotten trapped, I realized, even as I continued to plan my escape. I found myself apologizing to my own ancestors, apologizing for getting caught again after they worked so hard to free themselves. There was a poem one of my aunts read to me by a poet named Paul Dunbar. I understood it, finally, though I wish I never had. When his wing is bruised and his bosom sore, when he beats his bars and he would be free, it is not a carol of joy or glee, but a prayer that he sends from his heart's deep core, but a plea that upward to heaven he flings. I know why the caged bird sings. Every night in the common house, while I fell asleep, I dreamt of pale blue skies.
Elizabeth Baer. Elizabeth Baer was born in Connecticut and now lives in Brookfield, Massachusetts, after several years living in the Mojave Desert near Las Vegas. She won the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer in 2005, and in 2008 took home a Hugo Award for her short story, Tideline, which also won her the Theodore Sturgeon Memorial Award, shared with David Moles. In 2009, she won another Hugo Award for her novelette, Shoggoths in Bloom. Her short work has appeared in Asimov's, Subterranean, Sci Fiction, Interzone, The Third Alternative, Strange Horizons, On Spec, and elsewhere, and has been collected in The Chains That You Refuse and New Amsterdam. She is the author of three highly acclaimed SF novels, Hammered, Scar Down, and World Wired, and of the alternate history fantasy Promethean Age series, which includes the novels Blood and Iron, Whiskey and Water, Ink and Steel, and Hell and Earth. Her other books include the novels Carnival, Undertow, Chill, Dust, All the Wind-Racked Stars, By the Mountain Bound, Range of Ghosts, a novel in collaboration with Sarah Manette, The Tempering of Men, and two chapbook novellas, Bone and Jewel Creatures and Ad Eternum. Her most recent books are a new collection, Shoggoths in Bloom, two novels, Shattered Pillars and One-Eyed Jack, and a novella, The Book of Iron. Here, she paints a dramatic portrait of a scientist so determined to prove a controversial theory that she'll go to any length to do so, even if it kills her, which, on Venus, it well might.
The Heart's Filthy Lesson by Elizabeth Baer. Read for you by Janice Ian. The sun burned through the clouds around noon on the long Cytherean day, and Dorothy happened to be awake and in a position to see it. She was alone in the highlands of Ishtar Terra on a research trip, five sleeps out from Butler Base Camp, and, despite the nagging desire to keep traveling, had decided to take a rest break for an hour or two. Noon at this latitude was close enough to the 100th solar deaversary of her birth that she'd broken out her little hoard of shelf-stable cake to celebrate. The prehensile fingers and leaping legs of her bioreactor-printed, skin-bonded adapt shell made it simple enough to swarm up one of the tall, grass-hulf pseudo-figs and creep along its smooth gray branches until the ceaseless Venusian rain dripped directly on her adapt shell's slick, furred head. It was safer in the treetops if you were sitting still. Nothing big enough to want to eat her was likely to climb up this far. The grues didn't come out till nightfall, but there were swamp tigers, damn things, and velociraptors to worry about. The forest was too thick for predators any bigger than that, but a swarm of scorpion rats was no joke. And Venus had only been settled for 300 days, and most of that devoted to Aphrodite Terra. There were still plenty of undiscovered monsters out here in the wilderness. The water did not bother Dorothy, nor did the dip and sway of the branch in the wind. Her adapt shell was beautifully tailored to this terrain, and that fur shed water like the hydrophobic miracle of engineering that it was. The fur was a glossy, iridescent purple that qualified as black in most lights to match the foliage that dripped rain like strings of glass beads from the multiple points of palmate leaves. Red-black to make the most of the rainy gray light. They'd fold their leaves up tight and go dormant when night came. Darthi had been born with a chromosomal abnormality that produced red-green color blindness. She'd been about 10 solar days old when they'd done the gene therapy to fix it, and she just about remembered her first glimpses of the true saturated colors of Venus. She'd seen it first as if it were Earth, washed out and faded. For now, however, they were alive with the scurryings and chitterings of a few hundred different species of Cytherean canopy dwellers, and the quiet, nearly contented sound of Darthi munching on cake. She would not dwell, she would not stew. She would look at all this natural majesty and try to spot the places where an unnaturally geometric line or angle showed in the topography of the canopy. From here she could stare up the enormous sweep of Maxwell Montes to the north, its heights forested to the top in Venus's deep, rich atmosphere, but the sight of them lost for most of its reach in clouds. Darthi could only glimpse the escarpment at all because she was on the dry side. Maxwell Montes scraped the heavens, kicking the cloud layer up as if it had struck an aileron, so the wet side got the balance of the rain. Balance, in this case, meaning that the mountains on the windward side were scoured down to granite, and a non-adapted terrestrial organism had better bring breathing gear. But here in the lee, the forest flourished, and on a clear hour from a height, visibility might reach a couple of clicks or more. Darthi took another bite of cake. It might have been chocolate, it was definitely caffeinated, because she was picking up the hit on her blood monitors already, and turned herself around on her branch to face downslope. The sky was definitely brighter, the rain falling back to a drizzle, then a mist, and the clouds were peeling back along an arrowhead trail that led directly back to the peak above her. A watery golden smudge brightened one patch of clouds. They tore, and she glimpsed the full, unguarded brilliance of the day star, just hanging there in a chip of glossy cerulean sky, the clouds all around it smeared with thick, unbelievable rainbows. Waves of mist rolled and slid among the leaves of the canopy, made golden by the shimmering, unreal light. Darthi was glad she was wearing the shell. It played the sun's warmth through to her skin without also relaying the risks of ultraviolet exposure. She ought to be careful of her eyes, however. A crystalline shield protected them, but its filters weren't designed for naked light. The forest noises rose to a cacophony. It was the third time in Darthi's 100 solar days of life that she had glimpsed the sun. Even here, she imagined that some of these animals would never have seen it before. She decided to accept it as a good omen for her journey. Sadly, there was no way to spin the next thing that happened that way. "Hey," said a voice in her head. "Good cake." "That proves your pan is malfunctioning, if anything does," Darthi replied sourly. "Never accept a remote synaptic link with a romantic and professional partner. No matter how convenient it seems at the time and in the field, because someday they might be a romantic and professional partner you really would rather not talk to right now." "I heard that. What do you want, Kraken?" Darthi imagined Kraken smiling and wished she hadn't. She could hear it in her partner's voice when she spoke again anyway. "Just to wish you a happy anniversary." "Ah," Darthi said. "Aren't you sweet? Noblesse oblige." "Maybe," Kraken said tiredly, "I actually care." Darthi said. "What's the ulterior motive this time?" Kraken sighed. It was more a neural flutter than a heave of breath, but Darthi got the point all right. "Maybe I actually care." Sure, Darty said. Every so often you have to glance down from Mount Olympus and check up on the lesser beings. Olympus is on Mars, Kraken said. It didn't make Darty laugh because she clenched her right fist hard enough that even though the cushioning adapt shell squished against her palm, she still squeezed the blood out of her fingers. You and all your charm. You don't get to charm me anymore. Look, Kraken said. You have something to prove. I understand that. How can you possibly understand that? When was the last time you were turned down for a resource allocation, Dr. Youngest ever recipient of the Cytherean Award for Excellence in Xenoarchaeology? Dr. Founding Field Martius Chair of Archaeology at the University on Aphrodite? The University on Aphrodite, Kraken said, is 5 Quonset huts and a repurposed colonial landing module. It's what we've got. I peaked early, Kraken said after a pause. I was never your rival, Darty. We were colleagues. Too late, in Darty's silence, she realized her mistake. Our colleagues. You look up from your work often enough to notice I'm missing? There was a pause. That may be fair, Kraken said at last. But if being professionally focused, obsessed, is a failing, it was hardly a failing limited to me. Come back. Come back to me. We'll talk about it. I'll help you try for a resource voucher again tomorrow. I don't want your damned help, Kraken. The forest around Darty fell silent. Shocked, she realized she'd shouted out loud. Herring off across Ishtar alone with no support? You're not going to prove your theory about aboriginal Cytherean settlement patterns, Dar? You're going to get eaten by a grue. I'll be home by dark, Darty said. Anyway, if I'm not, all the better for the grue. You know who else was always on about being laughed out of the academy? Kraken said. Her voice had that teasing tone that could break Darty's worst, most self-loathing, prickliest mood if she let it. Moriarty. I will not laugh. Fuck you. Darty couldn't tell if Kraken had picked it up or not. There was a silence, as if she were controlling her temper or waiting for Darty to speak. If you get killed, Kraken said, make a note in your file that I can use your DNA. You're not getting out of giving me children that easily. Ha ha, Darty thought. Only serious. She couldn't think of what to say, and so she said nothing. The idea of a little Kraken filled her up with mushy softness inside. But somebody's career would go on hold for the first 50 solar days of that kid's life, and Darty was pretty sure it wouldn't be Kraken's. She couldn't think of what to say in response, and the silence got heavy until Kraken said, "Damn it, I'm worried about you." "Worry about yourself." Darty couldn't break the connection, but she could bloody well shut down her end of the dialogue. And she could refuse to hear. She pitched the remains of the cake as far across the canopy as she could, then regretted it. Hopefully nothing Cytherean would try to eat it. It might give the local biology a bellyache. It was ironically inevitable that Darty, named by her parents in a fit of homesickness for Terra, would grow up to be the most Cytherean of Cytherians. She took great pride in her adaptation, in her ability to rough it. Some of the indigenous plants and many of the indigenous animals could be eaten, and Darty knew which ones. She also knew, more important, which ones were likely to eat her. She hadn't mastered humans nearly as well. Darty wasn't good at politics, unlike Kraken. Darty wasn't good at making friends, unlike Kraken. Darty wasn't charming or beautiful or popular or brilliant, unlike Kraken, Kraken, Kraken. Kraken was a better scientist, or at least a better understood one. Kraken was a better person, probably. More generous, less prickly, certainly. But there was one thing Darthi was good at. Better at than Kraken. Better at than anyone. Darthi was good at living on Venus, at being Cytherean. She was more comfortable in and proficient with an Adaptshell than anyone she had ever met. In fact, it was peeling the shell off that came hard. So much easier to glide through the jungle or the swamp like something that belonged there, wearing a quasi-biologic suit of super-powered armor bonded to your neural network and your skin. The human inside was a soft, fragile, fleshy thing, subject to complicated feelings and social dynamics. And Darthi despised her. But that same human, while bonded to the shell, ghosted through the rainforest like a native, and saw things no one else ever had. A kilometer from where she had stopped for cake, she picked up the trail of a velociraptor. It was going in the right direction, so she tracked it. It wasn't a real velociraptor. It wasn't even a dinosaur. Those were Terran creatures, albeit extinct. This was a Cytherean meat-eating monster that bore a superficial resemblance. Like the majority of Cytherean vertebrates, it had six limbs, though it ran balanced on the rear ones, and the two forward pairs had evolved into little more than graspers. Four eyes were spaced equidistantly around the dome of its skull, giving it a dome of monocular vision punctuated by narrow slices of depth perception. The business end of the thing was delineated by a sawtoothed maw that split wide enough to bite a human being in half. The whole of it was camouflaged with long, draggled fur feathers that grew thick with near-black algae, or the Cytherean cognate. Darthi followed the velociraptor for over 2 kilometers, and the beast never even noticed she was there. She smiled inside her adapt shell. Kraken was right. Going out into the jungle alone and unsupported would be suicide for most people. But wasn't it like her not to give Darthi credit for this one single thing that Darthi could do better than anyone? She knew that the main Cytherean settlements had been on Ishtar Terra, knew it in her bones, and she was going to prove it, whether anybody was willing to give her an allocation for the study or not. They'll be sorry, she thought, and had to smile at her own adolescent petulance. They'll rush to support me once this is done. The Nauta dinosaur finally veered off to the left. Darthi kept jogging, swinging, swimming, splashing, climbing forward, letting the shell do most of the work. The highlands leveled out into the great plateau the new settlers called the Lakshmi Planum. No one knew what the aboriginals had called it. They'd been gone for, to an approximation, 10,000 years, as long as it had taken humankind to get from the Neolithic, agriculture, stone tools, to jogging through the jungles of an alien world, wearing a suit of power armor engineered from printed muscle fiber and cheetah DNA. Lakshmi Planum, ringed with mountains on four sides, was one of the few places on the surface of Venus where you could not see an ocean. The major Cytherean landmasses, Aphrodite and Ishtar, were smaller than South America. The surface of this world was 85% water. Water less salty than Earth's oceans, because there was less surface to leach minerals into it through runoff. And the Lakshmi Planum was tectonically active, with great volcanoes and living faults. That activity was one of the reasons Darthi's research had brought her here. The jungle of the central Ishtarian plateau was not as creeper-clogged and vine-throttled as Darthi might have expected. It was a mature climax forest, and the majority of the biomass hung suspended over Darthi's head, great limbs stretching up umbrella-like to the limited light. Up there, the branches and trunks were festooned with symbiotes, parasites, and commensal organisms. Down here among the trunks, it was dark and still, except for the squish of loam underfoot and the ceaseless patter of what rain came through the leaves. Darty stayed alert, but didn't spot any more large predators on that leg of the journey. There were flickers and scuttlers and flyers galore, species she was sure nobody had named or described. Perhaps on the way back she'd have time to do more, but for now, she contented herself with extensive video archives. It wouldn't hurt to cultivate some good karma with bio while she was out here. She might need a job sweeping up offices when she got back. Stop. Failure is not an option, not even a possibility. Like all such glib sentiments, it didn't make much of a dent in the bleakness of her mood. Even walking, observing, surveying, she had entirely too much time to think. She waded through two more swamps and scaled a basalt ridge, one of the stretching roots of the vast volcano named Sacagawea. Nearly everything on Venus was named after female persons, historical, literary, or mythological, from Terra, from the quaint old system of binary and exclusive genders. For a moment, Darty considered such medieval horrors as dentistry without anesthetic, binary gender, and being stuck forever in the body you were born in, locked in, and struggling against what your genes dictated. The trap of biology appalled her. She found it impossible to comprehend how people in the olden days had gotten anything done with their painfully short lives and their limited access to resources, education, and technology. The adapt shell stumbled over a tree root, forcing her attention back to the landscape. Of course, modern technology wasn't exactly perfect either. The suit needed carbohydrate to keep moving, and protein to repair muscle tissue. Fortunately, it wasn't picky about its food source, and Darty herself needed rest. The day was long and only half over. She wouldn't prove herself if she got so tired she got herself eaten by a mega spider. We haven't conquered all those human frailties yet. Sleepily, she climbed a big tree, one that broke the canopy, and slung a hammock high in branches that dripped with fleshy, gorgeous, thickly scented parasitic blossoms, opportunistically decking every limb up here where the light was stronger. They shone bright whites and yellows, mostly, set off against the dark, glossy foliage. Darty set proximity sensors, established a tech perimeter above and below, and unsealed the shell before sending it down to forage for the sorts of simple biomass that sustained it. It would be happy with the mulch of the forest floor, and she could call it back when she needed it. Darty rolled herself into the hammock as if it were a scent-proof, claw-proof cocoon, and tried to sleep. Rest eluded. The leaves and the cocoon filtered the sunlight, so it was pleasantly dim, and the cocoon kept the water off except what she'd brought inside with herself when she wrapped up. She was warm and well supported, but that all did very little to alleviate her anxiety. She didn't know exactly where she was going. She was flying blind. Ha! She wished she were flying. If she'd had the allocations for an aerial survey, this would all be a lot easier, assuming they could pick anything out through the jungle. And operating on a hunch, an educated hunch, but one that Kraken and her other colleagues, and more important, the Board of Allocation, thought was at best a wild guess and at worst, crackpottery. What if you're wrong? If she was wrong, well, she didn't have much to go home to. So she'd better be right that the settlements they'd found on Aphrodite were merely outposts, and that the aboriginal Cytherians had stuck much closer to the North Pole. She had realized that the remains, such as they were, of Cytherean settlements clustered in geologically active areas. She theorized that they used geothermal energy, or perhaps had some other unknown purpose for staying there. In any case, Ishtar was far younger, far more geologically active than Aphrodite, as attested by its upthrust granite ranges and its scattering of massive volcanoes. Aphrodite, larger, calmer, safer, had drawn the Terran settlers. Darthi theorized that Ishtar had been the foundation of Cytherean culture for exactly the opposite reasons. She hoped that if she found a big settlement, the remains of one of their cities, she could prove this, and possibly even produce some clue as to what had happened to them all. It wouldn't be easy. A city buried under 10,000 years of sediment and jungle could go unnoticed even by an archaeologist's trained eye and the most perspicacious modern mapping and visualization technology. And of course, she had to be in the right place. And all she had to go on there were guesses, deductions, if she was feeling kind to herself, which she rarely was, about the patterns of relationships between those geologically active areas on Aphrodite and the aboriginal settlements nearby. This is stupid. You'll never find anything without support and an allocation. Kraken never would have pushed her luck this way. Kraken never would have needed to. Darthi knew better than anyone how much effort and dedication and scholarship went into Kraken's work. But still, it sometimes seemed as if fantastic opportunities just fell into her lover's lap without effort. And Kraken's intellect and charisma were so dazzling. It was hard to see past that to the amount of study it took to support that seemingly effortless, comprehensive knowledge of just about everything. Nothing made Darthi feel the limitations of her own ability like spending time with her lover. Hell, Kraken probably would have known which of the animals she was spotting as she ran were new species and the names and describers of all the known ones. If she could have this, Darthi thought, just this, if she could do one thing to equal all of Kraken's effortless successes, then she could tolerate how perfect Kraken was the rest of the time. This line of thought wasn't helping the anxiety. She thrashed in the cocoon for another half hour before she finally gave in and took a sedative. Not safe out in the jungle. But if she didn't rest, she couldn't run. And even the Cytherean daylight wasn't actually endless. Darthi awakened to an animal sniffing her cocoon with great woofing predatory breaths. An atavistic response, something from the rainstem, froze her in place even as it awakened her. Her arms and legs, naked, so fragile without her skin, felt heavy, numb, limp, as if they had fallen asleep. The shadow of the thing's head darkened the translucent steel silk as it passed between Darthi and the sky. The drumming of the rain stopped momentarily. Hard to tell how big it was from that. But big, she thought. An estimation confirmed when it nosed or pawed the side of the cocoon, and she felt a broad, blunt object as big as her two hands together prod her in the ribs. She held her breath, and it withdrew. There was the rain tapping on her cocoon where it dripped between the leaves. She was almost ready to breathe out again when it made a sound. A thick, chugging noise, followed by a sort of roar that had more in common with trains and waterfalls than what most people would identify as an animal sound. Darthi swallowed her scream. She didn't need Kraken to tell her what that was. Every schoolchild could manage a piping reproduction of the call of one of Venus's nastiest pieces of charismatic megafauna, the Cytherean swamp tiger. Swamp tigers were two lies, six-taloned legs, and an indiscriminate number of enormous dagger-like teeth in a 400-kilogram body. Two lies, because they didn't live in swamps, though they passed through them on occasion, because what on Venus didn't. And they weren't tigers. But they were striped violet and jade green, to disappear into the thick jungle foliage. They had long, slinky bodies that twisted around sharp turns and barreled up tree trunks without any need to decelerate, and their whisker-ringed mouths hinged open wide enough to bite a grown person in half. All four of the swamp tiger's bright blue eyes were directed forward, because it didn't hurt their hunting. And what creature in its right mind would want to sneak up on a thing like that? They weren't supposed to hunt this high up. The branches were supposed to be too slender to support them. Dorothy wasn't looking forward to getting a better look at this one. It nudged the cocoon again. Despite herself, Dorothy went rigid. She pressed both fists against her chest and concentrated on not whimpering, on not making a single sound. She forced herself to breathe slowly and evenly, to consider. Panic gets you eaten. She wouldn't give Kraken the damned satisfaction. She had some resources. The cocoon would attenuate her scent and might disguise it almost entirely. The adapt shell was somewhere in the vicinity, munching away, and if she could make it into that, she stood a chance of outrunning the thing. She weighed a quarter what the swamp tiger did. She could get up higher into the treetops than it could, theoretically. After all, it wasn't supposed to come up this high. And she was, at least presumptively, somewhat smarter. But it could outjump her, outrun her, outsneak her, and, perhaps most important, outchomp her. She wasted a few moments worrying about how it had gotten past her perimeter before the sharp pressure of its claws skidding down the rip-proof surface of the cocoon refocused her attention. That was a temporary protection. It might not be able to pierce the cocoon, but it could certainly squash Dorothy to death inside of it, or rip it out of the tree and toss it to the jungle floor. If the fall didn't kill her, she'd have the cheerful and humiliating choice of yelling for rescue or wandering around injured until something bigger ate her. She needed a way out. She needed to channel 5 million years of successful primate adaptation, the legacy of clever monkey ancestors, and figure out how to get away from the not exactly cat. What would a monkey do? The question was the answer, she realized. She just needed the courage to apply it, and the luck to survive whatever then transpired. The cocoon was waterproof as well as clawproof, hydrophobic on the outside, a wicking polymer on the inside. The whole system was impregnated with engineered bacteria that broke down the waste products in human sweat or other fluids and returned them to the environment as safe, nearly odorless, non-polluting water, salts, and a few trace chemicals. Dorothy was going to have to unfasten the damn thing. She waited while the swamp tiger prodded her again. It seemed to have a pattern of investigating and withdrawing. Dorothy heard the rustle and felt the thump and sway as it leaped from branch to branch, circling, making a few horrifically unsettling noises and a blood-curdling snarl or two, and coming back for another go at the cocoon. The discipline required to hold herself still, not even merely still, but limp, as the creature whuffed and poked, left her nauseated with adrenaline. She felt it moving away then. The swing of branches under its weight did nothing to ease the roiling in her gut. Now or never. Shell! Come and get me! Then she palmed the cocoon seal and whipped it open, left hand and foot shoved through internal grips so she didn't accidentally avert herself into free fall. As she swung, she shook a heavy patter of water drops loose from the folds of the cocoon's hydrophobic surface. They pattered down. There were a lot of branches between her and the ground. She didn't fancy making the intimate acquaintanceship of each and every one of them. The swamp tiger hadn't gone as far as she expected. In fact, it was on the branch just under hers. As it whipped its head around and roared, she had an eloquent view from above. A clear shot down its black-violet gullet. The mouth hinged wide enough to bite her in half across the middle. The tongue was thick and fleshy. The palate ribbed and mottled in paler shades of red. "If I live through this, I will be able to draw every one of those 72 perfectly white teeth from memory." She grabbed the safety handle with her right hand as well, heaved with her hips, and flipped the cocoon over so her legs swung free. For a moment, she dangled just above the swamp tiger. It reared back on its heavy haunches like a startled cat, long tail lashing around to protect its abdomen. Darcy knew that as soon as it collected its wits, it was going to take a swipe at her, possibly with both sets of forelegs. It was small for a swamp tiger, perhaps only 200 kilos, and its stripes were quite a bit brighter than she would have expected. Even wet, its feathery plumage had the unfinished raggedness she associated with young animals, still in their baby coats. It might even have been fuzzy, if it were ever properly dry, which might explain why it was so high up in the treetops. Previously undocumented behavior in a juvenile animal. Wouldn't it be an irony if this were the next in a long line of xenobiological discoveries temporarily undiscovered again because a scientist happened to get herself eaten? At least she had a transponder. And maybe the shell was near enough to record some of this. Data might survive. Great, she thought. I wonder where its mama is. Then she urinated in its face. It wasn't an aimed stream by any means, though she was wearing the external plumbing currently. Easier in the field until you got a bladder stone. But she had a bladder full of pee saved up during sleep, so there was plenty of it. It splashed down her legs and over the swamp tiger's face, and Darty didn't care what your biology was. If you were carbon-oxygen-based, a snoutful of ammonia and urea had to be pretty nasty. The swamp tiger backed away, cringing. If it had been a human being, Darty would have said it was spluttering. She didn't take too much time to watch. Good a story as it would make someday, it would always be a better one than otherwise if she survived to tell it. She pumped her legs for momentum, glad that the sweat-wicking properties of the cocoon's lining kept the grip dry, because right now her palms weren't doing any of that work themselves. Kick high, a twist from the core, and she had one leg over the cocoon. It was dry. She'd shaken off what little water it had collected. Darty pulled her feet up. Standing on this stuff was like standing on a slack sail, and she was glad that some biotuning trained up by the time she spent running the canopy had given her the balance of a perching bird. Behind and below, she heard the Cytherean monster make a sound like a kettle boiling over, one part whistle and one part hiss. She imagined claws in her haunches, a crushing bite to the skull or the nape. The next branch up was a half meter beyond her reach. Her balance on her toes, she jumped as hard as she could off the yielding surface under her bare feet. Her left hand missed. The right hooked a limb but did not close. She dangled sideways for a moment, the stretch across her shoulders strong and almost pleasant. Her fingers locked in the claw position, she flexed her biceps. Not a pull-up. She couldn't chin herself one-handed, but just enough to let her left hand latch securely. A parasitic orchid squashed beneath the pads of her fingers. A dying bug wriggled. Caustic sap burned her skin. She swung and managed to hang on. She wanted to dangle for a moment, panting and shaking and gathering herself for the next ridiculous effort, but beneath her the rattle of leaves, the creak of a bough. the Knot Tiger was coming.
Climb, climb.
She had to get high. She had to get farther out from the trunk, onto branches where it would not pursue her. She had to stay alive until the shell got to her. Then she could run or fight as necessary. Survival was starting to seem like less of a pipe dream now. She swung herself up again, risking a glance through her armpit as she mantled herself up onto the bough. It dipped and twisted under her weight. Below, the swamp tiger paced, snarled, reared back and took a great outraged swing up at her cocoon with its two left side forepaws. The fabric held. The branches it was slung between did not. They cracked and swung down, crashing on the boughs below and missing the swamp tiger only because the Cytherean cat had reflexes preternaturally adapted to life in the trees. It still came very close to being knocked off its balance, and Darty took advantage of its distraction to scramble higher, careful to remember not to wipe her itching palms on the more sensitive flesh of her thighs. Another logic problem presented itself. The closer she got to the trunk, the higher she could scramble, and the faster the adapt shell could get to her. But the swamp tiger was less likely to follow her out on the thinner ends of the boughs. She was still moving as she decided that she'd go up a bit more first, and move diagonally, up and out, until up was no longer an option. She made two more branches before hearing the rustle of the swamp tiger leaping upward behind her. She'd instinctively made a good choice in climbing away from it rather than descending, she realized. Laterally or down, there was no telling how far the thing could leap. Going up, on unsteady branches, it was limited to shorter hops. Shorter, but much longer than Dartley's. Now the choice was made for her. Out before it caught up, or get eaten. At least the wet of the leaves and the rain were washing the irritant sap from her palms. She hauled her feet up again and gathered herself to stand and sprint down the center stem of this bough, a perilous highway no wider than her palm. When she raised her eyes, though, she found herself looking straight into the four bright, curious blue eyes of a second swamp tiger.
"Ah, crud," Darty said. "Didn't anyone tell you guys you're supposed to be solitary predators?"
It looked about the same age and size and fluffiness as the other one. Littermates? Littermates of some Terran species hunted together until they reached maturity. That was probably the answer, and there was another groundbreaking bit of Cytherean biology that would go into a swamp tiger's belly with Darty's masticated brains. Maybe she'd have enough time to relay the information to Kraken while they were disemboweling her. The swamp tiger lifted its anterior right forefoot and dabbed experimentally at Darty. Darty drew back her lips and hissed at it, and it pulled the leg back and contemplated her, but it didn't put the paw down. The next swipe would be for keeps. She could call Kraken now, of course, but that would just be a distraction, not help. Help had the potential to arrive in time. The idea of telling Kraken and everybody how she had gotten out of a confrontation with two of Venus's most impressive predators put a new rush of strength in her trembling legs. They were juveniles. They were inexperienced. They lacked confidence in their abilities, and they did not know how to estimate hers. Wild predators had no interest in fighting anything to the death. They were out for a meal. Darty stood up on her reaffirming knees, screamed in the swamp tiger's face, and punched it as hard as she could right in the nose. She almost knocked herself out of the damn tree, and only her windmilling left hand snatching at twigs hauled her upright again and saved her. The swamp tiger had crouched back, face wrinkled up in distaste or discomfort. The other one was coming up behind her. Darty turned on the ball of her foot and sprinted for the end of the bow. 10 meters. 15. And it trembled and curved down sharply under her weight. There was still a lot of forest giant left above her. But this bough was arching now until it almost touched the one below. It moved in the wind, and with every breath, it creaked and made fragile little crackling noises. A few more meters, and it might bend down far enough that she could reach the branch below. A few more meters, and it might crack and drop. It probably wouldn't pull free of the tree entirely. Fresh Cytherean wood was fibrous and full of sap, but it might dump her off pretty handily. She took a deep breath. Clean air, rain, deep sweetness of flowers, herby scents of crushed leaves, and turned again to face the tigers. They were still where she had left them, crouched close to the trunk of the tree, tails lashing as they stared balefully after her out of 8 gleaming cerulean eyes. Their fanged heads were sunk low between blade-like shoulders, their lips curled over teeth as big as fingers. "Nice kitties," Darty said ineffectually. "Why don't you two just scamper on home? I bet Mama has a nice bit of grew for supper." The one she had peed on snarled at her. She supposed she couldn't blame it. She edged a little farther away on the branch. A rustling below. Now that's just ridiculous. But it wasn't a third swamp tiger. She glanced down and glimpsed an anthropoid shape clambering up through the branches 50 meters below, mostly hidden in foliage, but moving with a peculiar empty lightness. The shell, coming for her. The urge to speed up the process, to try to climb down to it, was almost unbearable, but Darty made herself sit tight. One of the tigers, the one she'd punched, rose up on 6 padded legs and slunk forward. It made a half dozen steps before the branch's increasing droop and the cracking, creaking sounds made it freeze. It was close enough now that she could make out the pattern of its damp, feathery whiskers. Darty braced her bare feet under tributary limbs and tried not to hunker down. Swamp tigers were supposed to go for crouching prey, and standing up and being big was supposed to discourage them. She spread her arms and rode the sway of the wind, the sway of the limb. Her adapt shell heaved itself up behind her while the tigers watched. Her arms were already spread wide, her legs braced. The shell just cozied up behind her and squelched over her outstretched limbs, snuggling up and tightening down. It affected her balance, though, and the wobbling of the branch. She crouched fast and grabbed at a convenient limb, and that was more than tiger number 2 could bear. From a standing start, still halfway down the branch, the tiger gathered itself, hindquarters twitching. It leaped, and Darty had just enough time to try to throw herself flat under its arc. Enough time to try, but not quite enough time to succeed. One of the swamp tiger's second rank of legs caught her right arm like the swing of a baseball bat. Because she had dodged, it was her arm and not her head. The force of the blow still sent Darty sliding over the side of the limb, clutching and failing to clutch, falling in her adapt shell. She heard the swamp tiger land where she had been, heard the bough crack, saw it give and swing down after her. The swamp tiger squalled, scrabbling, its littermate making abrupt noises of retreat as well, and it was falling beside Darty, twisting in midair, clutching a nearby branch, and there was a heaving, unhappy sound from the tree's structure, and she fell alone, arm numb, head spinning. The adapt shell saved her. It, too, twisted in midair, righted itself, reached out and grasped with her good arm. This branch held, but it bent, and she slammed into the next branch down, taking the impact on the same arm the tiger had injured. She didn't know for a moment if that green sound was a branch breaking or her. And then she did know, because inside the shell she could feel how her right arm hung limp, meaty, flaccid, humorous, shattered. She was dangling right beside her cocoon as it happened. She used the folds of cloth to pull herself closer to the trunk, then commanded it to detach and retract. She found one of the proximity alarms and discovered that the damp had gotten into it. It didn't register her presence, either. Venus. She was stowing it one-handed in one of the shell's cargo pockets, warily watching for the return of either tiger, when the voice burst into her head.
Dar!
Don't worry, she told Kraken. Just hurt my arm getting away from a swamp tiger. Everything's fine. Hurt or broke?
Wait! Swamp tiger?
It's gone now. I scared it off. She wasn't sure, but she wasn't about to admit that. Tell Zamin the juveniles hunt in pairs.
A pair of swamp tigers?
I'm fine, Darthi said, and clamped down the link. She climbed down one-handed, relying on the shell more than she would have liked. She did not see either tiger again. At the bottom, on the jungle floor, she limped, but she ran.